So, welcome to Theatre Voice. I'm talking to Professor Colin Chambers, who's just written this remarkable book that traces the history and development of Black and Asian theatre in Britain over the last couple of centuries. Colin, welcome to Theatre Voice.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about how this project came about.
I was interested in the subject because when I was a theatre critic back in the 1970s, I saw a lot of Black and Asian theatre, which seemed to me to be amongst the most interesting things I saw at the time. And then when I became an academic, which was some years later, I realised that no one had really written about the whole area of that theatre, and particularly hadn't written about its history and where it came from. And so it was something I felt it was a gap that ought to be filled. And I got the impression that people hadn't really understood that there's a much longer history that they think it probably all started in the 1970s. And I was keen for people to have a picture of what came before that.
Right, so you kind of kept this thought in your brain for over 20 years and you just started working on this
project.
Well,
I suppose I didn't... It wasn't until I became an academic, which is after I left the professional theatre, because my own career path, if you can call it such a thing, was from being a journalist. I then went to work for the Royal Shakespeare Company. Mm-hmm. And when I left the Royal Shakespeare Company, I became an academic, in a sense, by accident. And at that point, I was looking for subjects to write books about. And it was then that I returned to this idea. And I suppose I was also... slightly nervous because it's not really my own culture. I mean, it's my culture in the sense that I'm British and it's part of British culture, but I'm white, so I'm not part of any of the communities out of which this theatre grew. Mm-hmm. And there's always a slight question of what did I know about it? You know, would I be intruding in some way? And I thought, well, if I'm a theatre historian, then perhaps I could bring something else, a different perspective to that history. And I talked to Jatinder Verma, the artistic director of Tara Arts, mm-hmm. about a book which was going to celebrate their 25th anniversary. But we couldn't find a publisher that wanted to do that. But I'd done some work on... trying to put this idea out into the publishing world. And when that fell through, I thought maybe what I should do is broaden it out and just do a book myself, but not just about Tara, but about, the broader perspective. And it seemed to me that those groups from the 70s, which for me was the point of which something which was called Black Theatre, began to have its own identity, that needed to be unpicked, but also that there was a sense in which I wanted to make it feel part of the British theatre history as well, that it wasn't something separate. And so I had, if you like, different impulses, and I'd always been interested in theatre that was not mainstream. Although I worked for the Royal Shakespeare Company and wrote two books about the RSC, yeah. The first books that I wrote were actually about fringe theatre, and one in particular, a book on Unity Theatre, which is a left-wing amateur theatre. So it fitted in with my interests, if you like, in theatre that challenged from what was considered to be the margins, but actually... was probably more central because it was bringing in different sorts of energies and different theatrical vocabularies, which in the end became something that whatever we call the centre wanted to have. And that was true of Unity, when Unity introduced things like the Living Newspaper or Vernacular Theatre or things like that. That then became mainstream later on with the Royal Court, let's say, for example. And I think you can see the same sorts of things happening with Black and Asian theatre, where I suppose the most obvious example is people like Andrew Lloyd Webber wanting to cash in on the sort of the Bollywood phenomenon. So something that starts off as being marginalised actually then becomes something that's quite mainstream.
Yeah. Well, I said it's a remarkable book, and it is. I mean, it's just a fascinating read because it's amazing to hear that black and Asian theatre, that we've got a kind of a heritage that goes back certainly to the beginning of the 20th century, if not earlier in some cases. You've sort of given us a little bit of a history of the black presence in England in the earlier centuries, and then you just go on to talk about the evolution of this form in the UK. Do you want to just explain a little bit about that, please?
Yes, the book is unfortunately much shorter than I wanted it to be, because once I started digging into it, I thought, A, you had to have some sense of history, first of all. You can't divorce theatre from social and political history. Mm-hmm. And obviously, if you're a marginalised group, that's even more the case. But I think it's true of all theatre. And so I wanted to go back and look at how what is now called in academic terms the other, i.e. non-white presence, was represented in British theatre. And that, it seemed to me, when I discovered how many plays, let's take the beginning of the modern professional theatre at the end of the 16th, beginning of the 17th century, Shakespeare's time and his contemporaries, how many plays feature people who are the other, are non-white. And it's clear that England in some way was having this exchange with other cultures. That's something we try and not really talk about very much. When I was brought up at school, it was a very white history, as if somehow the rest of the world didn't exist. Mm-hmm. And so it seemed to me it was important to try and begin the story as far back as possible, even if at that time we don't really know about, let's say, black or Asian or non-white theatre practitioners. As far as we know, there were likely to be some performers, but no writers. But the performers, as far as history is concerned, don't really come into the picture other than in quite sort of small ways or street fairs or whatever until the 19th century. But I thought it was important to set up that background, because a lot of the preconceptions that the British theatre had come from that period. A lot of the stereotypes which were engendered by the theatre, not in isolation, I mean, as part of a whole apparatus of ideological formations, whether it was in fashion, in religion or whatever, but architecture, but theatre played its part in representing the other in a racist way, and of course that fed the empire, and the empire then fed that. But when you get to the point where there are black or Asian artists trying to work in the theatre, the context is immediately one of a racist nature. In the 19th century, it was primarily to do with the minstrels and all the racist connotations of the minstrel body. So, for example, an actor like Ira Aldridge, African-American, comes to England in the early part of the 19th century. People want him and expect him to perform like a minstrel. And so he has to find strategies to put through his own view of how he wants to perform within that context. So it seemed to me it was important to have explained in some way how that context came about. And that persists right through into the 20th century, well, actually still now, that those stereotypes were at work when black and Asian theatre practitioners were trying to create a space for themselves and to build some sense of an autonomous theatre space where the image they have of themselves could be presented, and not just the image that, if you like, the white theatre had. For most of that period, they had to work within the white theatre, using these terms in rather broad sense, but you know what I mean. Yeah. And certainly at the beginning of the 20th century, which is, I suppose, in a sense where the story really picks up, because in the 19th century, Aldridge was a almost unique character. I mean, there were a couple of other African-American actors who came over and played Shakespeare.
Is that someone like Samuel Morgan Smith?
Yes, Samuel Morgan Smith, yeah. Was an important figure after Aldridge. And I think it's important that these people have their place in our British theatre history. But they were obviously isolated as well. They their impact is limited, although Aldridge is I think, by any yardstick, a major figure.
Are they coming from America?
Yes, they came from America because it was impossible in America for them to perform. And they wanted to perform Shakespeare, interesting. I mean, Aldridge didn't just do Shakespeare. He had a very wide repertoire. But that was clearly something they felt, if you were in the theatre, you know, as it were, the legitimate theatre, that's what you did. You know, that was the sort of pinnacle. And you were being judged against that.
But I think that's even today would be true for Black and Asian actors. They want to be able to do play a Lear or a Hamlet.
Exactly. I mean, I think that's
those kind of roles.
And you couldn't do that in America. If you were a Black American, or Black anything, but I mean, if you were African American, that wasn't possible. And so they came to England. And there was more opportunity. Aldridge is it's difficult to generalise about that because he found trouble in London because of the pro-slavery lobby that supported certain sections of the press, which attacked him viciously and said, you know, this sort of nigger shouldn't be on our state, you know, on our national stages. I mean, I suppose one shouldn't be surprised and how overtly racist it was. You know, they talked about he couldn't speak the language and he had big lips and all the classic stereotypes. Right. And they hated it when he played Othello because he was said to be pawing a white actress who was playing Desdemona. And this reoccurs. You get this when Robeson plays Othello in 1930 opposite Peggy Ashcroft. The press are full of all this, the black man kissing a white woman on stage. So it happened to Aldridge, and then it's still happening in the next century with Robeson.
So in the context of black theatre, it seems to me that you're getting professional actors from America coming over in the early part of the 19th century.
Yeah.
And you're also getting some professional playwrights coming over.
The British here didn't get any black playwrights until the very end of the century, as far as we know. There is a case of one guy who wrote some melodramas, but they...
Is that who's that? Are you talking about Henry Francis Downing?
No, he's the one with Pan-Africanism at the end of the 19th century. Henry Francis Downing is another African-American who comes to live in London. He writes and has published half a dozen plays. And from what we can gather, he was going to have them put on, but then the war broke out. And they were never, as far as we know, staged. And then he went back to the States. So all we have is the scripts that are published.
The First World War broke out.
Yes, sorry, yeah, right. Yes. And then he returned to America. But they, you know, there's a core of work there, which I don't think most people in the British theatre have ever heard of. And partly because, as far as we know, it wasn't staged, it sort of remained locked away.
I'm just trying to see if there is a kind of a big difference between the development of black and Asian theatre. So in the context of black, it seems to me you're getting professional actors initially coming over to the UK to appear on the professional stage.
In terms of black theatre, the African-Americans were very important. And in a sense, they were the first impetus. A lot of them came and some stayed. Particularly those who are active in light entertainment. But through that, you started to get a pool of people who were available in commercial entertainment. And Paul Robeson is probably the best-known example. But at the same time is that you've got people coming from the British colonies, mainly the Caribbean, who are in London and looking to take part in theatrical activity. And they coalesce around the time of Robeson in various places that are usually what we would now call the fringe, which didn't exist in these small theatres that were doing progressive, what we call progressive plays. And there's usually a connection there between the left wing and this activity. And I suppose the best example, or the best known example of that, is when Robeson played Toussaint Louverture in the C.L.R. James play of that name in 1936. And Robeson was playing the main part, but all the other black parts, or most of the other black parts, were played by people from different British colonies. There was a slight tension between the ones that considered themselves British, because they were part of the British Empire, and the African Americans, of course, who weren't. And the what we could call the black British artists became...
I think we have similar debates now as well.
Yeah, they became increasingly upset that people like... I mean, Robeson, I suppose, is a difficult one because he was clearly such an extraordinary performer. But you read of them complaining that Robeson gets all the parts first, and then they have to, you know, they play his understudy or whatever. And then after the Second World War, that becomes even more acute.
Mm-hmm.
When you get in the West End, you get all black shows coming from America, and you get the black British actors complaining even more vociferously that they're not being considered for other than, you know, roles like, you know, the usuals of butlers or chauffeurs. In the Asian histories, is very different because the relationship, because the black body, as it were, was considered to be a slave body by the white theatre, and so that's background. Whereas the Asian body was a completely different one. The relationship with India was completely different, and of course India had a culture that was seen by certain sections of the British intelligentsia in Sanskrit culture as being much, you know, obviously was older than British culture, and they could venerate it in a way that there wasn't an equivalent in black culture.
But didn't they see it as exotic?
Yes, it was not something they saw in a sense as an equal. They found it extremely interesting, but in that exotic way. And throughout the 19th century, certainly, the whole image of Asia, which was something, you know, under a big umbrella called the Orient or the East, and there was absolutely no distinction really between, you know, Chinese or, you know, Southeast Asia or whatever.
Or I mean, Turkish or...
Or Turkish, yes. It was just
like
a great
that.
Lump.
Right.
And that comes from the theatre of Shakespeare's time as well. You get exactly that thing. It's all sort of lumped together. But there was a fascination, but it was based around stereotypes, because people and cultures use stereotypes to organise information, and it's easier for them to accommodate things if they've got a sort of a box they can stick it all in. So the East tended to be mysterious. I suppose when it came to women, it was alluring and possibly dangerous for that sort of reason. But you'd have some dance troupes coming over from India, and there wasn't really an equivalent of that from the black side, because it was, I suppose, the only equivalent was minstrelsy, if you like. So when you get to the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, you actually get some figures from the Indian community in London who start to use the fact that there are these intellectuals who are interested in Asia to find a space to say, well, we'll show you and we'll put on plays. And I suppose the best example there is Kedarnath Dasgupta, who sets up his own theatre group.
Which is called?
It had several names, but okay. When he started... Actually, the first production that we've got records of was a production of Buddha at the Royal Court. And if you look at the program, it looks as though it's actually being put on by there was a white director called William Pohl, who was a very important director at the time. But actually, it's an Asian production, and they were very pleased because Pohl was the way in which they could get access to the Royal Court. But they're downgraded, as it were, although it was their production. But after that, it became his organisation, his theatre organisation became known as the Indian Art and Dramatic Society. But it also operated under another umbrella, which is called the Union of East and West, which was, there were several of these sort of organisations trying to bring, if you like, understanding between the two cultures. And this was a very successful one in terms of the sorts of programmes it had of lectures.
This Kedarnath Dasgupta was a Bengali student in London, so
yes,
it's like the students getting together and was, putting
yes,
a play on.
It was mainly, as far as we can tell, it was from the student community, because it was there was obviously quite an established Indian student community, and it wasn't unusual for Indian students to come to England mainly to study law and medicine. Those were the two big things that they studied.
But no actors emerged out of it in terms of like names.
The only actor that I know, unless there were people who went back to India and became actors, that I don't know about. But Rai, the film actor, came out of this world. Himanshu Rai.
Oh, Himanshu Rai,
yeah.
the producer and actor
yeah.
for Bombay Talkies,
yes.
which is like in the 30s, a film studio
yeah.
in India.
He was
part of that.
He
as
was
well?
Part of this circle.
Right.
He worked with Niranjan Pal, and
who was another student.
He was a student as well. I mean, Dasgupta seems to have become Pal's mentor in some way, because Pal acted in this production of Buddha, which was the first one that Dasgupta really...
Of course, Niranjan Pal, again, was another young student who came
yeah.
here because his dad wanted him to be away from the nationalistic politics
yeah,
at the time.
That was also true of Dasgupta. He was in trouble because Dasgupta supported nationalist causes and was against the partition of Bengal, and from what I gather was getting close to being involved in, or perhaps was involved in, things that would have got him into trouble with the police, and in order to avoid that was sent to England. So there's a similar story with Pal as well, as far as I know.
But Niranjan Pal, I mean, listeners may know that he ended up being one of the pioneers of the silent film movement,
yes, yeah.
writing the films like Light of Asia
yes.
and A Throw of Dice, those early films in the beginning of the 20th century.
And he wanted to be he wanted to be a writer. And having acted in Buddha, he then started to write and then got involved
in... And Buddha was in 1912, is that right?
Yes, yeah. And which is pretty early when you think about it. But the decade after that, Dasgupta must have been responsible for, I don't know, more than 20 productions of both Sanskrit classics and the new Indian plays, which were exclusively the work of Rabindranath Tagore, who was a
poet at the time, who would have just been winning his Nobel Prize.
He was a close friend of Dasgupta's.
Oh, right.
And they went to America together in 1920.
I mean, it is interesting that in the context of the Asian theatre experience or heritage in the UK, these Sanskrit plays have come up again, because somebody like Tara has done a little clay
yes,
cards a couple
yeah.
of times in
yes.
the 70s and the 80s.
Yes, yeah.